What's going on, guys, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Let's Just Talk podcast. I'm super excited to have you back and excited to have this week's guest. As many of you know, I was just at a conference just a couple of weeks ago, and a couple of great speakers there and a couple of great presentations, and one of which was this week's guest. I think it's an area that I just don't think gets kind of highlighted enough. I think too many people suffer with chronic pain for months, years, longer than they probably necessarily have to, because for fear of movement and whatever might come from what their understanding is around that pain. And I think this presentation really highlighted a different way of thinking that many of you might not have thought about. And it's something I think we can all benefit from. So before I go too much further into it all, Brendan, I really appreciate your time, mate. And thanks for joining us here today.
Yeah, thanks, Adams. Thanks for having me on.
No, not a problem. Well, I kind of was just sharing off air to yourself, but I kind of selfishly have a little kind of, I guess, back end to kind of why I wanted to have you on the show. And I've always shared that I love having these conversations and having these guests on because I benefit from them. And I hope in turn from me benefiting that the people listening in benefit from it. But if I kind of go back a few years ago, the reason why I really wanted to kind of reach out to you is that when you shared on your presentation, the I guess the case study that you had there, you had that athlete that you kind of were working with, you know, she broke down in tears when you kind of got her to move a certain way that she hadn't, and she had always been so fearful. She'd been to so many different practitioners with regards to the pain she'd been experiencing and this understanding that she had around it, that I can't now do this particular exercise, I can't move this way. I had a very similar kind of setup with a client many years ago before I kind of really understood chronic pain and pain to, I'm not even an expert on it now, but I would say I understand it a bit better than I did kind of 10 years ago as a practitioner, but a very similar understanding that I understood or began to understand just the power that your words and the way you say things and how you kind of ask questions to a client can really kind of unlock their thought process and how they go about it. And I understood then just how kind of beneficial you can be with not just having to deal with the injury itself that might be in front of you, but kind of going broader. And so I kind of really wanted you to kind of, I guess, open up that world to us and kind of what you've been doing, the research you've done, the work you do, and kind of how you go about it and this biopsychosocial type model around pain. And hopefully in today's talk, those listening in might kind of start asking different questions of their practitioners that they do see, or maybe open up their minds that might see them not have to live with the chronic pain that they have been living with for many years.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, it's been, you know, quite a journey. When I sort of look back at my early stages of my career as a healthcare practitioner, it was very much involved in this biomedical model. And I'm going to contrast, I guess, the biomedical model to this biopsychosocial model that you kind of just spoke about then, which was what my talk was talking about. You know, what is biopsychosocial care? We can talk about it, it sounds fancy, all of that, but what does that really mean and how does it look in practice? And so I was kind of like really grounded in this biomedical model, which is fundamentally, when we're talking about pain, trying to find this underpinning thing that's going wrong in that individual. So whether or not it's, you know, something wrong with the nervous system very specifically, or the movement pattern, or the tissue that's broken, basically reducing someone down to their bare parts. And theoretically, if we can fix that one thing, then that person will go on and thrive and get back to whatever they're doing. But what we tend to see is actually a really good portion of the population end up having pain that goes on beyond the normal healing times of tissue. So this model has kind of failed us in many ways, but it's still a very prevalent model in our healthcare industry, in the ways that if something doesn't work, we go try and pinpoint someone's issue and we try and fix it with, you know, sort of movements or interventions or even surgery. And if that pain continues, they'll go and seek more help and usually be told something else in line with this biomedical model, that there's another thing that we've missed or so on. And so these diagnoses and these different tissues all start getting pathologized and become more of, you know, a part of the issue. And what the biopsychosocial model does a little bit differently is it kind of steps back and says, all right, hang on a second, biology is involved always, it's always going to be a part of it. But we're dealing with a human being here. And as it turns out, pain and injury is far more complex than just something going wrong in a tissue. Even if we know, you know, you sprain your ankle, we know that there's some tissue damage going on there, that pain you're experiencing is influenced by far more than that damage in that tissue. So yes, we've got some signaling coming from that tissue, but we're processing it through a huge amount of previous experience, the things we've done in the past, what we know about the world, what we know about our ankles, whether or not we've rolled our ankles before in the past, whether or not we're worried about how this is going to impact our, you know, current state, our ability to do our work, do the things we enjoy doing, all of those sorts of things can influence how intense that pain is that we experience, and how likely it's going to, I guess, attenuate alongside the healing of that tissue as well. And so essentially, we know that tissue damage and pain are two separate things. So pain does correlate with tissue damage. You know, we can hurt ourselves and we often feel pain at the same time, but there's not a one-to-one relationship. There's lots of things that influence the, you know, how we experience that pain. And so we can have no tissue damage at the end of the day and still have very real pain. And it's not just in our head. And I think that's where my attention is really focused to in terms of my research, my clinical practice is going, all right, hang on a second. How do we deal with people in a way that treats them as a person and looks at all of the factors that are going to influence their experience, not only the tissue, but also how they're responding, how they think about it, how they're interacting with their environments, and so on. So it's taking a little bit more of a complex approach, but it ends up being a little bit more simple because there's more options on the table now that we can play around with in someone's treatment or in their strategies to work towards recovery than what we initially had on the table, which was just that tissue-based pathology kind of answer.
The idea kind of that kind of made me start questioning a little bit more around my own kind of biomedical approach that I took in my very early days of being an exercise physiologist myself was, I remember hearing something, it was a quote along the lines of, might not even mean a quote, but it was kind of told along the lines of, when you get told you're sick, you tend to often feel more sick. And it was kind of like, you know, you go to the doctor, you got a runny nose and the doctor says, oh yeah, you've got bronchitis, you're going to be sick for the next couple of days. And so you kind of talk yourself into going, oh, well, the doctor said I'll be sick for the next couple of days, so I'm sick for the next couple of days. Whereas if you might have gone, oh, the sniffle's not too bad, I won't go to the doctor, I'll just stay home, I might stay a little bit active to try and work myself through it, take rest when I need to, and you get better within a day's time. I remember that kind of scenario kind of coming up and going, hang on, if we get told a certain thing by a professional that we're, you know, relying and trusting on, that they know more than I do, that's why I'm going to them for their help, then it makes sense that we trust what they're saying. And so if they say that I'm meant to be sick, or they say that you've got this injury, therefore this is what will happen and this is the pain you will experience, that it kind of almost self-prophesizes kind of that pain in, or that kind of idea with inside you. And so I guess the question kind of comes up with people listening in, and you know, they might be sitting there as they're driving to work while they're listening to this podcast, and geez, my back's been sore for so long, and I just saw the physio last night and they said, yeah, you've got this slipped disc and therefore that's why your back is pain, like, you know, causing you this pain or this discomfort. Where do kind of people start from, and like what questions can they ask, or what practitioners can they look for to kind of actually start moving forward from living in that kind of bubble that is, you're injured, therefore that's what your pain is and that's what your experience will be?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot in that. And I think what you're kind of referring to when you're sort of talking about, you know, when you're told you're sick, you feel more sick. That's what we kind of term the nocebo. A lot of people are probably very familiar with the idea of a placebo, which is, you know, a positive outcome or a positive influence on your symptoms generally, from the things that are said and from what you kind of believe about a treatment per se. But it's a real effect, as in there's real physiology that occurs when you experience a placebo. So if you believe something that is going to be helpful, or you have an expectancy that's going to be helpful, it actually has the ability to kind of turn down the amount of sensory information we're sampling, and kind of de-threatens that information as well. So it kind of works on a lot of different physiological pathways. So it's not a make-believe thing. It is a real physiological response based on our thoughts and our beliefs, and can be influenced by what we're told by our healthcare practitioners, social media, our family, our friends. Our whole belief system can really influence that. But then on the flip side, the arch nemesis of your placebo is a nocebo. And that is when, you know, you're told something like you've got a slip disc, or you've got the spine of a 70-year-old and you're not yet 70 years old, or that, yeah, you're going to be more sick. We know that people with colds, even, we've got experimental data of this, of people who have colds, and they're told, hey, look, your symptoms are really, really bad and it's probably going to last a while. They have a stronger inflammatory response than those who do not, and their symptoms tend to last longer. And that's literally just from the words and the messaging that they're given. There's no actual active ingredient in that other than influencing our physiology through our thoughts and our beliefs. And that's a deep physiology. So it's not just in your head. It's a body-wide physiological response to an idea, a thought, an expectation. And we're very malleable about that, which is really, really cool in one respect, is that we can influence our physiology through the way we think about things, the way we think about movement, the way we interact in our environment, a whole bunch of different ways. And it can be positive, or it could be negative, or it could be indifferent though as well. And so I think, to kind of come back to your question about, you know, what can we be asking of our healthcare practitioners, if, you know, all the focus feels like it's just been around treating a tissue or fixing my tissue, and you don't feel like it's necessarily improving a whole lot, having, you know, a discussion about, you know, I've noticed that my symptoms are a bit different at these times. Like, if you can think about when your symptoms may be worse, you know, is it, you know, in different contexts, or, you know, different situations with different people, you know, what is it that influences your symptoms? Is it just loading that tissue all the time, or are there other things that influence that? If the symptoms are kind of ongoing and you're going, look, we've been doing this treatment for a while, I wonder if there's something else we can be doing. Maybe the question needs to be a little bit about that. But bringing up these situations and having a conversation about them, just going, hey, look, I've noticed that my symptoms are worse when I am, you know, with my children, you know, which happens from time to time. You know, the children stress you out. We know we have a physiological response to stress, and that can heighten the intensity of our experience of pain. Asking the question, can you explain to me a little bit more about why that's happening and what I could be learning about that might be helpful to get some control of my symptoms, that might not be just what you're doing to me, but also just, you know, questions around, you know, you've been doing, you know, these very specific things to me, that's great, I feel like there might be some relief from that from time to time, but I'm really interested in knowing what else I could be doing in my own time to get a little bit more control of this situation as well. And that's, I think, really important. A lot of, I think, therapists, you know, make sure that you've got something to do. But if you're finding that it's not helpful, I think we need to be like, as patients, be really open with that and just say, hey, look, I can't find the time for it. I don't see the value in this. It doesn't seem to be helping. You need to tell your clinicians that, because it means that we're not ticking the boxes that you need. We're not prescribing exercises or interventions or strategies, or helping you with strategies that you see value in or that you find helpful at this stage. So if you don't understand why you're given it, ask. If you want something different, it's not working with your lifestyle, bring that up. Have a conversation about it, because obviously you want to get better. And by bringing up those conversations, your clinician's going to be like, oh, actually, right, I need to maybe even learn a little bit more about this, or I just didn't think you'd be interested in looking at these other active strategies that you could be involved with. So yeah, all right, let's have a conversation about that.
To talk on, just to kind of push back on that psychology just a little bit on there, is that I know I would feel this way, and I've experienced it time and time again with clients. I try and introduce as much of an empathetic kind of environment as I can, as much of a caring environment I can, and trusting environment, that a client, be them someone that I've seen for the first time or someone that I've known for 3 years, can say, look, Bob, if you ever have any questions, concerns, or things that you want to bring up to me, I'm here to listen. I'm not someone who's going to shut anything down. I want you to be open with me, because the only way I can get the best outcome for you is if we have an open line of communication. But so often, and again, I'm guilty of this myself when talking to my own health practitioners, like be it a doctor or a physio or whatever it is, I was like, oh, I don't want to look stupid in front of them. I don't want to ask that question. And it's not until kind of someone's pushed up against the wall or something really kind of goes wrong with their kind of progress forward, or they really feel like I have to now, rather than kind of getting on the front foot and asking it before those things build up. Is there any advice you can give to the psychology of just the human mind of like, I don't want to question them, or I don't want to kind of step on their feet or feel like I'm going against what they've asked me to do? Is there something you can suggest to people to kind of maybe override that feeling that we all kind of have as human beings?
Yeah, totally. I think if you consider like the reason why us healthcare practitioners went into these roles in the first place, and it's the answer I get from almost every healthcare practitioner I speak to, you know, why did you do this in the first place? It's to help people. They genuinely want to help you. And I think we put in a lot of effort to create a safe space and a place of empathy where you can share and be open. But sometimes we just don't completely click. The trust isn't completely there yet. And so if we can kind of just keep in mind, you know, when we are in that sort of patient role, to be like, actually, they really do want to help, and their job genuinely feels more rewarding to them when they feel like they're helping. Asking these questions help them do their job better, help you get back and recover from, you know, what you're dealing with and re-engage. So just trying to, I guess, even remind yourself that you can help your clinician by bringing up some of your fears and concerns. And they're not as crazy as you might even think it sometimes. You know, the amount of different things that healthcare practitioners have heard, nothing generally phases us too much these days. You know, once you've been in clinical practice for a few years, you go, you know what, we're just all humans trying to look after each other. So the more open and honest we can be about that, the better. And we don't always have all the answers, but we can definitely facilitate some, you know, really helpful strategies to start exploring and finding different ways that are going to be helpful for you. And I think that's an important part, is that, you know, especially when we're talking about chronic pain, is that what works for one person is unlikely to be exactly how, you know, helpful for the next person as well. And the only way, so we don't have this textbook that is, if we follow these rules, which is essentially what the biomedical model proposed, if we follow these rules, everyone will recover. Well, we wouldn't have chronic pain now if that's how it worked, unfortunately. So by having these open dialogues of being able to share how it's affecting you, things that you find helpful and not helpful, and all of that can be really, really helpful in helping us guide you as well to explore different strategies that will help you re-engage and to recover from what it is you've got going on. Because it's a big problem-solving sort of expedition, if you will, for a lot of people. And there is hope, and that's what's really beautiful. But that hope is fundamentally more there if we can have that open dialogue, if we can kind of really share our experiences and be open. So, you know, and I think that comes down to, if you feel like you can't open up with your clinician, then perhaps look for someone else that you feel really comfortable with, that you can share those stories with, and that listens and that tries to support you and facilitates different strategies to explore to move forward.
It's interesting you bring up that idea. As I said, there's no real textbook response that kind of works for everyone. And I guess this idea, as I said, here's X problem. If I just insert Y kind of response to it, it'll kind of fix that up from. I guess not only us clinicians, but you know, the general public as a whole have this sense, because it's kind of been drilled into us for so long, that you know, it usually is a cause and effect kind of issue. And you know, this is not to beat down on physios or EPs or anything like, but so many physios, EPs, and people in the profession for years, and it's certainly getting better, and I think our approaches and how we're kind of moving forward has been much better, but for years have been saying to our clients as well, is like, I can see on your, you know, your scan, here's the slip disc, or here's the nerve issue, or here's the you know, torn meniscus, or here's the issue. This is the pain that you've got in, and this is kind of the way we should move forward. How do we kind of, as a profession, but then again, the people listening in who are more the general public listening in, how do we kind of move away from trying to, it's kind of unlearning, I guess, you know, can't teach an old dog new tricks kind of things. Like, how do you kind of now start inserting this idea that, okay, cool, just because I've got this injury, and as you said, biology does play a role in it. You could have fallen over and you could have drastically twisted your knee and it caused some tearing, or you had a big issue at work and you hurt your back, and there is an underlying biology there to it. But how do we then kind of move beyond just relying that, okay, I was injured, therefore this is what I got to do? Can you explain a little bit more kind of what that bio, psycho, social kind of, what those three components are, and I guess how to then utilize all of them in kind of using that as your kind of recovery process?
Yeah, totally. So I guess one of the things is with the, you know, the biological, the psychological, and the social things, at times we've kind of almost bastardized that idea and going, oh, it's more of a psychological problem. And then people go away thinking it's in their head, or it's more of a social thing, or it's more a biological thing. And so we end up reducing them down into these, you know, bare parts again. But if you think about it like you're baking a cake, when you're putting in your eggs, your flour and sugar, once you put them in, they're all mixed together. There's no separation of them. And if you think of it like this, if you have a thought, right, if you were to think of someone right now, and I want you to think about someone dislocating their knee. Just, you can see the patella sliding out to the side. It's moving around to the other side of the knee. Does that give you a bit of like a gross sort of feeling just thinking about that?
I can remember someone from high school who did it, who I was in front of them while they were playing football. So yeah, it brings up memories instantly of seeing that.
Yeah, so you've got a previous experience to rely on there a little bit as well. And I've dislocated my own knee in the past too. So for me, it gives me this visceral response. But there's a real physiological response to that thought. Okay, so as in, you can probably find that your heart rate starts to increase a little bit. You're getting a bit of that fight or flight, sympathetic nervous system effect going on. You're getting more adrenaline and your stress hormone, your cortisol pumping through your body. You are literally responding to just that thought, all right? And that's not even something within the constructs of your thinking. But we are also always embedded in an environment. So we can't separate ourselves from our environment, from our thoughts, and from our biology. They're always interplaying all the time. It's completely interconnected. And so the way that we interpret the sensory information coming from our body can be completely influenced by what we're thinking, but also what's in our environment, what we're seeing, what we're hearing, all of those elements. Because we know when we injure a tissue, they're not pain signals coming from that tissue. We call it nociception. And what nociception is, it's essentially just these danger signals coming up from the periphery into your spinal cord, and they get sent up to your brain, and your brain starts processing that. And it processes it with all of the other sensory information it's got available to it, as well as all of its previous experience also. So this other sensory experience includes what's happening around you. At the same time. So in that, there's a whole bunch of different factors that are at play that can influence your experience of pain, but also influence how much threat you have to that area of the body. And we want a relatively accurate representation, right? Like if we've just, like I said, dislocated our knee, it's in our best interest that we don't start loading it, right? And then we just start, you know, keep running or whatever it is we were doing beforehand. It's in our best interest that, you know, we experience pain. So it stops us in our tracks. It's pretty motivating to do that, that we can then either relocate it or we can seek emergency support who can then reduce the dislocation. And then, you know, that leads us to being able to recover faster and so on. You know, it protects us, but it's always biopsychosocial. So it's kind of going away from this idea of, you know, oh, it's just this damage in the tissue. That's all we've got to worry about, because that person is going to be worried about their recovery, how they're going to get back to work, how they're going to make a living, perhaps how they're going to get back to their sport, you know, what this means for their ability to train, to you know, maintain their elite performance, whatever it might be. And how we take that into consideration when we're listening to a patient, how we're formulating the rehabilitation plan, completely dictates how they're going to engage in that rehabilitation, how they're going to start recovering in terms of their symptoms, and, you know, appropriate loading of that tissue as well, so that they are, you know, safe enough during the stages of tissue healing, but also so their nervous system starts to calm down with a bit of time and that pain doesn't, you know, persist longer than that normal healing time. So it's really about just considering all of these other factors that are influencing that recovery, and influencing that nervous system that is there to protect us.
Absolutely. And what I kind of wanted to do today, because I always kind of go into a podcast thinking, at least what I want as one minor, you know, minor thing every single time from someone listening to this podcast, is they can walk away with some sort of actionable thing that they can do, like be it a small piece of information that they come across, or there's something that we talk about that say, hey, ask this question, or start asking these questions of yourself, or whatever it might be. I thought, if you don't mind indulging me, and I'm going to put you into practitioner mode kind of thing now, and it's very rare that I'm ever a patient, but can I kind of, and I think this will probably really help people out, because I'm sure there's many people, I'm going to use the back, because I think backs are something that, you know, everyone has probably dealt with some sort of back pain, be it acute or be it chronic pain over many weeks, months, or years. But can I kind of come to you as a client, as a patient with chronic back pain, and kind of, I guess, paint a picture for you, and you kind of run me through kind of an initial kind of 15-minute consult of what it might look like, so people can then start like, I've had back pain, and how Adam explained that, and then how Brendan would, that sounds amazing. Like, I might start it. Like, is that something that you'd be interested in kind of, yeah, helping us out with today?
Yeah, sure. Let's do it. I'll send you the bill afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually got a bad back at the moment. This is going to be a good thing. So yeah, like if I came to you, and I guess the usual kind of client that I've seen over the years, because I've always worked in musculoskeletal rehab as an exercise physiologist, and backs have been, I guess, 60% of my workload, be it someone who's hurt themselves on site and it's been a work cover client, they've said you need to go to get back to work, or it's someone who's been dealing with chronic back pain. And so I'm going to come to you as a client is like, hey, Brendan, you know, I've been seeing this physio and I've seen about 14 other physios in the time, and I've got this slip disc and I hurt my back 5 years ago at work when I was lifting something, and I've been through work cover and it just never seemed to get good, and I always seem to hurt myself, and I think I'm going to hurt it every time I go to work. My boss keeps on my back that I have to keep working because I'm not moving fast enough, and look, I just need it to be fixed. Can you help me out?
Right. Yeah, it sounds like you've really engaged in trying to find a solution, Adam. Sounds like you put a lot of effort into that, and yeah, it's a bit sad that you're still dealing with it this far down the track. But so what is it that you think is causing your pain? Why do you think you're still dealing with it so far down the track?
Oh, it's definitely a slip disc, like L4, L5. I had the scans done and I've got a slip disc, and I can't remember what they said, but it's some sort of grade 400 tear or something I've got in there. I don't know what they kind of were talking about, but it was a really bad slip disc and tear that I had there. And it's definitely related to that. And it kind of comes and goes, but at the moment it's just really bad.
Yeah, cool. And so you've been told that you've got this slip disc. What does that mean to you? Like, if you were to sort of explain that in your own words, what's that mean going that is going on?
What I've been told, and I guess what I kind of understand from my limited knowledge, is that like one disc has moved over the top of another and it's pinching my nerve, and that pinching of that nerve is what's causing all my pain. And that, you know, it spreads down my leg. Sometimes it's in my bum. Sometimes it goes all the way down to my toes and I lose sensation and I've got all this pain. And then sometimes it's great.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So when you are getting this sort of loss of sensation, these changes in your leg, is there anything in particular you've been doing beforehand? Is that related to any particular movements or any particular times of the day, et cetera?
Look, work's been super busy. And as I said, my boss is an arsehole. He's always on my back to try and, you know, get me moving and get me moving. There's always, you know, things, targets we've got to hit and keep moving. And I guess when I'm super stressed and there's lots going on, you know, because I'm working so much harder, that's when it probably tends to flare up, because I'm doing so much more movement and so much more work at work.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then when you're outside of work, you're not doing a whole lot, or what are you doing? What kind of stuff are you up to?
I mean, I love to run. I love to get to the gym, but just because of work being so busy and life getting in the way, I got two crazy kids that kind of keep me occupied, and a wife that never stops nagging at me. And I don't get to the gym as often as I like, and I don't get to run as much as I like. But I certainly love doing them. But again, I don't have the time, and you know, my back's been so sore at the moment. I don't want to go to the gym, and I don't want to run because it tends to flare it up if I go there.
Yeah. Okay. So you find it's worse when you're sort of at work, when you're, you know, really loading it, moving lots, all that sort of stuff. And then how are you finding it outside of that? Your symptoms, you know, you talked about a flare up. Can you talk me a little bit through how your symptoms are when you're at home, when you're with family, when you're doing all of these other things?
Look, if I'm in a good routine with my gym, like if I can get there and like, you know, work, even if it is busy, I try and make time for it. I'm definitely better when like I can get into those things that I really enjoy, be it, you know, going to the gym. And as much as the kids and the wife run me up the wall, I do enjoy spending time with them. Like, you know, I really do enjoy that family time. I just don't get enough of it these days. I'm up at 5 o'clock, I'm in the office by 6, and I don't get home till 6. And then the kids are manic at the end of the day and they're crazy running around. So I'd love to spend more time with them. I just don't have the time to spend time with them and get into the gym and do the things that I need to do for myself as well.
Yeah, cool. And so are there any particular types of movements that you're finding difficult, or, you know, talk me through that.
Work has a lot of sitting, but then also a lot of physical work. So like I could be sitting for hours, but then have to get on the floor and do some moving. I'm kind of in manufacturing, and I'm a manager down there. So sometimes I'm in the manufacturing floor kind of helping the team out, but then I'm up at the office. So if I'm kind of in the office sitting all day, it can get, you know, really like getting up, I feel like an 80-year-old man kind of standing up and getting moving after sitting at the desk for, you know, 6 hours straight. But then on the flip side, if I've spent a lot of time on the floor and doing a lot of manual work, it also tends to flare up a little bit in there. But it's definitely worse when I'm just sitting at a desk all day.
Yeah, right. So it sounds like when you're not doing a whole lot of movement, that tends to be worse. But then there's a point where you do too much movement and it's not so great either.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And so has there been any times when you've kind of found a sweet spot within that where, you know, a good amount of movement and, you know, it hasn't been so bad, or is
yeah, the end of the month is always the crazy time because we've got end of month reports and writing, and that's when I'm just doing so much sitting. But kind of, I guess at the start of the month when kind of everything resets and it's kind of back into a normal routine, I do less time at the office and I get to get into my routine of getting to the gym and, as I said, spending time with the family and things like that. That's definitely when it's much better because I'm not just sitting so much at work.
Yeah, cool. And when you are, you know, sitting and it's worse, why do you think that sitting would make it worse?
Well, I've been told that the spine, you know, it needs movement to kind of help me get going, but I can't get going because I have to sit all day because, again, my boss is an asshole, so that's why there. But like, I definitely feel like when I move, that what I've been told, that movement just helps that spine, and I don't know what happens, but it flushes it with good things and whatnot to help it kind of move better. I don't know, but that's what I've been told.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, that's I think pretty accurate and sounds really good that you can get a bit of movement and that can be really, really good. So why do you think it is that when you do too much, that makes things worse? What do you think is going on there?
I don't know. We had some work health safety guy come in a while back and show us correct lifting techniques. And I did that for the team because that was what they needed on the floor. And I think I just, I'm in too much of a hurry and I tend to lift incorrectly and I twist and I don't bend correctly. And you know how they, but I mean, I don't have time to get down and do the proper lifting. I just have to get shit done and get moving. And so I tend to probably lift bad and that kind of then hurts my back. And that's when I can have flare ups as well.
Yeah, right. So have you had any days where you have managed to lift, you know, correctly throughout the day?
I'm not going to tell this in front of the boss because he'd yell at me, but no, I'll probably not. I never kind of lift correctly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's really interesting about that is that how you lift generally isn't well related to how you're actually feeling as well in terms of damage to your back and so on as well. So by moving and lifting in the way that's easiest for you, that's not necessarily doing you any more damage. But at the same time, it sounds like you are, you know, dealing with a bit of a flare up afterwards. And that might be just because you are moving more than what your body and your nervous systems can currently tolerate. And it also sounds as though, from what you've said, that too little movement, your body or your nervous system also doesn't like that a whole lot as well. Is there any change coming up for you at all in terms of your work? Is there any ability to modify any of these things, or is this kind of fixed for you at the moment?
It's probably fixed for me at the moment. Yeah, I'm kind of in a pretty senior role in the workplace, and so unless I'm taking my boss's job, which I don't see happening anytime soon, I'm probably in this role for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and then outside of work, you're kind of not really doing too much of the other stuff you enjoy at the moment by the sounds of things. So the running that you used to like doing and the gym, all that sort of stuff, that's not on the cards generally because of your symptoms. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I just, if I'm feeling a bit tender in the back, I get a little bit scared of then going to the gym and feeling like I could overdo it. And then, you know, before what you said, you know, movement might not necessarily, I didn't know that. I haven't heard that before. So that's interesting to hear. But yeah, I feel like I can't go to the gym because I might do something that can then flare it up even worse. And then time off work, I can't afford. And so, yeah, I just kind of tend to steer clear from it.
Yeah, that sounds sensible from what you've told me so far. But is that something, if you knew you were safe and that, you know, you might still experience some pain, but you weren't going to be in any more risk of, you know, damage or anything like that, would you be open to sort of exploring some gym work or even returning to some running or something along those lines?
Yeah, sure. That's I'd love to get back into the gym and know that I'm not causing myself any extra harm or potentially re-injuring myself.
Yeah, cool. So what we might be able to do is actually, you know, get you in there and have a little bit of a look, you know, how you're moving, and find what you kind of enjoy doing and try and maybe see if there's anything we could be doing that might help you in a different way. I understand like you're doing all of this movement and loading at work and that's not great. And then also, you know, the sitting's not great as well. But sometimes what we can find is by doing movement in some different ways and some different contexts and in ways that we kind of enjoy can really get some of our, what we call our endogenous opioids. So our natural painkillers that we've got within us starting to flow a little bit more as well. And we can also find that we can develop a little bit more capacity to handle some of those things. So sometimes it doesn't seem like completely intuitive to do more, but we might be able to find some opportunities of some of these other things that you enjoy doing that you're currently not doing and play around with some of those to see how that influences how you go while you're sitting at work at the moment and, you know, when you're on the you know, warehouse floor. Because it sounds like at the moment there are things that are not really on the table that we can kind of play around with and modify. And, you know, it sounds like you're doing a bloody good job to, you know, keep going and whatnot. And it sounds horrible that you know, still dealing with these symptoms, but it sounds like we've got to try and find some different ways, you know, to do it a little bit differently, or do something differently with you that is modifiable within your lifestyle, and we can kind of play around and see how you respond to that. How's that sound?
That sounds good, mate. And I know I've got a time crunch with you, so I don't want to kind of run out of time, mm-hmm. but I mean, sorry to kind of cut you off there, but I think that, and I hope that kind of played out well in your mind as well. I really loved kind of playing that role play. And I hope that kind of people listening in kind of get a sense of just how different a kind of an approach it can kind of be. And I would take a guess that many people who are experienced back pain and have gone to see a physio or a trainer in some capacity, be it an exercise physiologist or someone in the gym, have not probably heard that kind of approach far too often. And again, I've been guilty of it very early in my career. It's certainly very different these days. And I would think I'd have a very similar approach to what you have just had then. But it would be, morning, Bob, welcome, what's your pain? Oh, you got bad back, you sit too much, work. Cool, let's get into the gym, let's get you moving. And I'll look at the way you move and, oh, that's not good, let's correct. Like, I think that's kind of usually a very normal approach. And so I love doing that with you. And I really do hope that, again, that's brought value to people listening. And I appreciate, again, your expertise and kind of your sense that you've kind of helped through there.
Yeah, no worries, mate. It was a bit of fun to be thrown on the spot and hear your story. So.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think, as I said, backs are one of those things that I think a lot of people can relate to in some sort of capacity, whether it is something that people have been debilitated by for years or whether it's just something that it's a little niggle that I think most people can relate with. So I hope that they go away with some of the things that you've already said that they can maybe like, you know what, I haven't thought about it that way. Maybe I can start taking some of those actions, move in some of those favorable ways that, you know, I enjoy that. And you kind of explained how we have some natural, you know, painkillers within ourselves that when we do things we enjoy and move in ways that we enjoy and feel good about, that we actually can kind of have that kind of benefit from there.
Yeah, that's it. And I think if I was to highlight kind of one component of that is generally it's trying to just find something and doing different. Like we've all been told these different things and a lot of it can be really conflicting. And it's not necessarily to go, oh, who's right? Who do I trust here right now? Is you can test out some of these things yourself and see if the wheels do fall off the bus. So if you've been told that, hey, you need to have your core on all the time or your glutes should always be switched on or that you have to move in this perfect way, you know, lift with your knees, not with your back, you know, that, you know, sort of advice that we started to talk about there, you know, the research around is actually phenomenally interesting because it doesn't probably support what you'd actually think to the extent that you'd think. But the thing is, it's not to go and go, oh, that's bullshit. It's go, all right, let's see if that holds true for me. What happens if I do this movement that's usually quite uncomfortable? What if I do relax my core or relax my glutes? What if I just think about lifting the box, however's easiest for me right now, and just see how it feels? And quite often, we find that some of those behaviors have become, you know, early on, it's adaptive because it's helpful, but had become maladaptive over time. It creates more tension, more stress, more worry, and more concern that drives these kinds of behaviors that no longer serve a purpose. So we can kind of go out and start just exploring things bit by bit. I mean, don't get silly and go, oh, I wonder if I lift, you know, a 300 kilogram barbell right now, and you haven't done that in a long time. Probably don't start there, but we can start experimenting with some little things of just going, what if I just do it differently? How does it feel? And it doesn't have to be pain-free, but do the, you know, wheels fall off the bus? Do I actually go, oh, actually, I can do that. That's okay. How do I grade that up to doing more and more of that or with more load or in different contexts? And that could be running, could be anything that you want to get back to. But like you touched on, Adam, is quite often when we've got chronic pain, the first things we drop are the things that we love and enjoy doing. And that has a huge value. The more people have control over, you know, the things they enjoy and can get back to those, generally recovery is better. So that's probably the, you know, hopefully that, you know, the big take home is just clear some of that noise and explore some of these things for yourself. A little bit of permission to be like, okay.
That's awesome. For people who might want to reach out to you or maybe engage with you if they're kind of nearby or whether you do online consulting or whatever it might be, how do people get in touch with you? And I always say, I'll put it in the show notes anyway, but to kind of verbally say it, please let us know where we can get a hold of you, mate.
Yeah, probably the best email is just Brendan, Brendan, at tkex.org. That's probably the best email. Otherwise, if you're on Twitter, it's just Brendan Mowatt, spelled Mouatt. That's my handle. But yeah, that's probably the best ways. But yeah, feel free to reach out if you do have questions or whatnot. But yeah, have that conversation with your therapist or your GP about, actually, I just want to make sure that I'm safe to explore some of these things. Would you, you know, help me explore some of these? Do you think I'm safe to do that? And I think that's probably a great place to start.
That's awesome, mate. I appreciate that. And I always like finishing up the podcast, as I've done many times in the past, by asking a random question that came from last week's guest. And if you don't mind indulging me with your answer to the question, what is your spirit animal?
Oh, I'm going to say a golden retriever. I can be a bit, as you've noticed, a bit rambly, so a bit all over the shop with everything. But generally, you know, always going to be there in the end, digging holes in the backyard somewhere. Yeah, so
I love it.
Retriever.
I love it. Can I then just ask you your random question for next week's guest?
All right, next week's guest. So what about, what's something that you strongly believed in the past that you have changed your mind on significantly? And how has that sort of come about, that change of a strong belief?
Just writing that down. So I've got, what's something you strongly believed in the past that you have changed your mind on significantly, and how did that come about?
Yeah.
I love it. Great question. I look forward to asking that of next week's guest. But for this week's, mate, I really appreciate your time. And again, I appreciate your time and your presentation that I got to sit in on up at the conference. And then I appreciate you answering my email and responding positively and jumping on here. And again, I always say that I think I've found value from the chat, and I certainly have, and I appreciate that. But I'm hoping that people listening in have found some value on the conversation we had, the little role play we had there, and the little gold nuggets that you threw out throughout the chat. So I really appreciate that, mate.
Yeah, no problem, Adam. It's been a pleasure.
Excellent. Well, guys, as I said in the show notes, you can reach out to Brendan with the details that he threw out there for today. If you need anything else, my email and details are there below as well. But that's been another episode of this week's Let's Just Talk podcast. I'll see you next week. I love you all. Bye.